Welcome to the podcast Rare Mind Talks, where we explore leadership, innovation, and real impact in healthcare and beyond. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by Erika, founder of the SatB2 European Foundation and an inspiring advocate working to improve the lives of patients and families across Europe and beyond. Erika, it's great to have you here. Thank you for accepting the invite.
Thank you, Andre. Thank you for having me.
So let's maybe start with your story. Would you be able to, you know, to share how your journey as a mother led into your patient advocacy and eventually founding the SatB2 European Foundation?
Okay, so the journey was not very short because my son was diagnosed when he was only 8 years old. So basically, before the diagnosis, I was working as a clinical pharmacist at the university hospital. And since he was 3 years old, we were really kind of looking into advocacy in the field of undiagnosed, because we started the journey when he was of searching for the cause of his difficulties already when he was 6 months old. But at that time, at the age of 3 and 4, there was still, you know, nothing concrete what is the cause. And we were really struggling with that period of being undiagnosed. So basically, initially, I started as an advocate for undiagnosed and try to establish something here in our country, in Slovenia, to support those parents and patients. Yes, but then after the diagnosis, it felt more, let's say, secure and much more straightforward what we should do. So this diagnosis came to us when he was 8 years old. And at the time, I already left my job because it was overwhelming to take care of my child and have a very demanding job far away. So yes, when the diagnosis came, I said, well, what can we do? And I realized we were the only case, the first case in our country at the time. And there was around, I don't know, 150 patients known in Europe, and in the globe, less than 300. And there were already few foundations. Well, one, the biggest one is in US, and three other national in Europe with the bigger countries like UK, France, and Spain. And I felt, well, we can do something on a European level, because in rare disease, connection is, you know, everything. Not establishing a national association, rather European. So we did it. Together with two other parents, one from Sweden and one from Austria, and formally established a European Foundation here in Slovenia. So this is how it started in 2021. Yes, I hope that answers your question.
I found amazing how the not having a diagnosis actually leads to so much in the next years, and that is the story. Also to that I would like to talk to you about and learn from you as well, Erika. And you mentioned about the foundation. So let's connect that journey to how you lead today. And you've mentioned patient centricity. When you make decisions for the foundation, how do you ensure that, you know, the patients, you know, that fuel that led you to create the foundation is always at the center?
Well, when you are a parent to such a child, it's not so difficult, because you know what the needs are, or at least you have much better idea than if you were a founder and not related to this area. So that's one important thing that leads you. It's true that, as you know, foundations per se are not a membership organization. So it's not incorporated directly the voice of patients, which is different in associations, you know, where you have a annual assembly and, you know, people share their thoughts. So here, mainly the board makes, let's say, the bigger decisions. So yes, we do face these questions, like what is, in the best interest of the community. And of course, sometimes it's difficult to explain or to, to connect with parents because their daily needs are, related to many things, either, therapy, social services, education. And in Europe, we have a special challenge because we have very different systems, different languages. So these are all the barriers. And then it's not so simple to, offer something that will help everyone in Europe. And it's also true that for a lot of those things that people need, either additional money or, respite care or better education, it's something that they can access normally in their country with other nonprofits, not for their specific syndrome, but for, let's say, within rare disease in general, or even other things like for different disabilities or, for cerebral palsy, or like different organizations that offer different summer vacations or AAC devices, or, give funding for different therapies. So when we started, you cannot cover everything, all the needs. And our core idea, our mission was basically more on a bigger level. Let's say how we can improve healthcare for our children across different systems in Europe, and how can we move forward research towards, let's say, tangible treatments. So this is beyond of everyday needs, and sometimes I think families have more difficulty to understand what we're doing because the effects are not visible very quickly. We are now working over like almost 5 years now, very hardly to create a clinical guideline, first global clinical guideline to establish a reference center in Europe. So none of this existed or exists at the moment, but it's in progress and on a good way to get to see the light, let's say, in the next year. So these are a lot of things that you have to establish when you start from scratch. So like networks with clinicians, networks with families, if there is, no associations in different countries. So there's a lot of work that can be done without any money, practically. Just with a lot of emails and so yes, let's say we always have a patient in mind in the center for these generations and for next generations. So sometimes that's an issue because research sometimes is, even more for new generations, and you feel, okay, what we can do for our kids now. So these are all the things that you want to do at the same time. Yeah, so I hope that gives a little bit of picture what that means. So there are different levels, and let's say for our foundation, I can say the focus is how to improve the system behind, so that no one that will get a diagnosis in these years will be left alone, or they will know there will be guidance for their clinicians, there will be resources out there that they can read and learn and so on. So yes, this I think families will appreciate very much when they are all implemented, but sometimes it you think you have nothing to show. Yes.
It sounds like a little bit the imposter syndrome when you are actually doing so much, but then things take this natural time to become
Yes.
to live. And you've mentioned focus a couple of times, Erica. And from what you've described, there's the right focus there, but the engagement isn't always an easy one to work out, which is quite interesting because a lot of times we assume that the parents affected, the families affected, are naturally engaged on these type of discussions, but it's not always the case. And this is not only with the SATB2 Foundation. I see that with many conversations I have with different rare diseases associations as well. Why do you think many families struggle to participate in advocacy efforts?
Well, there can be many reasons, and one, I think the main one is they are a parent to a child with challenges, which is on its own quite a could be a burden or an issue or how to say it's something that you have to learn how to live with, to organize your life, to reorganize your life. So that's one, and then you. Everything that comes with that, also partnership, siblings, financial issues. Then the other layer is language barrier. We have bigger groups in France and Spain and Italy, and not so many parents speak fluently English. And then that's the reason that they not engage as much as they maybe would if. They could communicate in their language on such, on a European level decision. So that's another thing. And like I said, maybe some doesn't feel an effect that will happen tomorrow, and they don't see how this will help their child on a shorter term, and that maybe also is not a good motivation. But from my experience, it really depends on also the personality, and we have parents that are very engaged locally to get to advocate for schooling, for social services, and we have parents that doesn't do that. So it's also comes to personalities, competencies, many things that influence that. So yes, as a leader of such an organization, I would wish there would be more parents able to contribute. To have some extra time to dedicate for our cause, because there's loads of things to do, and then if with more hands it gets easier or quicker. But yes, these are all the reasons that are very realistic, and this is how the real world function in, let's say, a rare disease space or in any kind of special challenges that the families face.
Let me deep dive a little bit on that one, because you said yourself, I mean, you are kind of leading in this space, in not just on the foundation, it's also on the European networks and so many other initiatives. So for sure, what you've described impacts somehow your leadership style, and it makes it a little bit more complex to motivate and bring all these people together. So how do you do this? How do you motivate people, given the challenges that you've described? How do you motivate people and bring everyone together under those conditions? And let's bear in mind, as you've mentioned as well, that there's not a lot of financial incentives to do everything that needs to be done, right? So which makes it even more complex.
Yes, I mean, there are two things. So one is, as we talked before, motivating parents, to contribute, to be actively involved. And the other thing is to motivate clinicians and other experts. They are all normally very busy clinicians. They see a lot of different syndrome patients, and it's not very common, or they cannot afford to focus very deeply on one, except if this is really their research area, where they really, publish and do a lot of research. And yes, we on our case, we have a very, the main researcher is from US for our syndrome. And that is why also I think at the beginning in Europe there were not a lot of experts or clinicians really highly motivated or involved in this syndrome or in this research for syndrome. So that was at the beginning quite a struggle to find, to locate those clinicians and then motivate them to join the consortium, for example, for these guidelines. But eventually we did it. So we started with a handful of clinicians globally, and now we have over 60 clinicians, 6-0, that are in our consortium, and also clinical psychologists, for example, and speech therapists. And yes, of course, it's a huge challenge how to motivate those experts and also parents. that are part of this consortium to do the work, which is on top of their everyday obligation, because we don't have any financial stimulation. It's all very for a higher cause, for a higher good, you know, like, and I don't know how we do it, basically, just encouraging them and showing what difference their work is making or will make. And I think it's also when someone is very dedicated and motivated and doesn't give up, also motivates others to not to give up, you know. I think maybe that's also something that I learned. So, because this is the feedback that I get, you know, because I sometimes also struggle how to, you know, how to motivate people, how annoying I can be until it's too much, you know, like if someone doesn't respond to an email and then when to send another one, how to phrase that they would still, you know, not being too bothered, but still do what you want them to do. So these are on a daily basis decisions that we have to make. And the feedbacks, many times I feel I'm the bad guy, you know, someone that is all the time there hanging on their heads. And the feedback from some that I got was basically, yes, it's good that you are doing that, you know, that someone is doing that. And people, when they see something is organized, that someone is, you know, still kicking and moving forward, that's something that at the end also helps everybody to be engaged, you know. And if there's some good progress made, then it's just, you know, kind of start the wheel turning, you know. But the first steps are, you know, yes, you a big effort.
Eric, you brought this up to another level when you decided to go European at the European level and beyond, rather than just at the country level. Is that how, also how you motivate and, you know, and break down the cultural barriers across different countries? Because, as you said, I mean, there are different systems, different mindsets, languages, barriers within Europe. So is it bringing that energy, that leadership that breaks down these barriers and bring everyone together at a European level?
I mean, I try to. I think important thing is that everybody feel welcome, that their contribution is valuable. That's important thing. So they feel welcome, although maybe they hesitate that may I don't have nothing to share or something like that. But yes, I think at the end, when they really are there, they grow, let's say, in a way that see, okay, yes, I'm here. I do have something to say, for example. So, I mean, these barriers now, I don't see much of them. Of course, they will have different opinions, clinicians on a certain topic coming from different systems. And maybe sometimes even just the level of communication, some are very friendly, open, kind of, and this is normal for them. And for some are used to be very, you know, hierarchic or like very more formal. But I think then, you know, if there are at least few in the group that are more open, friendly, and then it starts to be more natural, everything, you know. And it also depends on the chair or like someone who's leading the group, how they deal with that. And so there's a lot of factors. But I think everybody likes to kind of be part of a group, at least as an idea. Not necessarily that they then enjoy teamwork, but because many researchers are also very, you know, used to work on their own, and it's another level of challenge for them. But I think through this process, now I'm more or less having in mind these guidelines, which I'm currently very deep dive into it. It's like all this process really helps us all to learn how to communicate with each other, how to have a parent within the working group as a equal partner, And yeah, it's a process, but I think we're doing good.
And all the parties play their role, right? So families bring their own knowledge, clinicians bring their own knowledge, and in a space like rare diseases, where information is so siloed and so fragmented, we need to bring all this information together so we can make any progress. And that leads me then to the decision-making process, and again to the word focus, because you've mentioned, and I, you know, I just it keeps me reminding me. That there is so much to do with so limited resources. So decision making here is quite critical. How do you decide where to focus your efforts on some sort of priorities and not feel overwhelmed with so much that there is out there to be done?
Yeah, it's no simple answer to. I mean, at least I haven't found a magic, stick to say, well, this is the best idea, or this should be the first thing to be done among many options. So this is still something that we learn, and I think since we established also scientific and medical advisory board, with the hope that they would also help us, make good decisions where to start, or where to, where to start, where what to fund at the beginning, because of course you have to plan it in a way that whatever you do will then help you decide on the next step, and you start probably small if you don't have resources with something that is not so, let's say, expensive, but will give you good information on what to do next. So I think having coming up with the research agenda is something that is crucial for every rare disease organization. So what are the priorities, or like first, what goals you have, what you want to achieve, and then go back. So what are the first steps that we when we will be there at the end, what will lead to another, to another step. But sometimes it's truly not so easy to identify what is the first step, or even if you know what it is, it's sometimes not just financially, but also organizationally and on many levels very difficult to organize it. Either this is data that you need, or this is, a certain lab that will really engage with your research work, and normally you have to find that lab that or a research group if it's not already there. But then of course money is the key to make the real progress. But before the money, you have to have a plan, because it can ha easily happen that you see opportunities here and there. Oh, that would be nice, that would be nice, here is this grant and that, and then you end up with having so many different small projects, but not with a red line. Okay, this is point A where we start, and this is where we want to go. But it's all over the place, and I think it is not as effective, let's say, or it, because I think in rare disease, time is very crucial.
Yes.
So we have to think wise, or we have to be wise in choosing which projects, and yeah, and also the sequence.
Indeed, indeed. And we've been talking about your story, the foundation, the different players within the foundation. But this is, and as you've mentioned as well, not a work that one can do alone. It doesn't work in isolation. So there are many organizations already working in this space, and many also working with the SATB2 European Foundation. How do you approach collaboration versus keep creating new initiatives?
I mean, for sure, we are always looking for similar, let's say, one thing is to find similar conditions that we can do something together. And I think one part is that ERN and Ithaca, so the European Reference Network for Intellectual Disability Autism, where I think you're also involved with. So this is one network where we try to work across different syndromes, so to work on similar issues that we share, but then it's also similar conditions in terms of pathology. So very on a, let's say, of course, we want to first correct the brain if may say so. So you look on a similar pathways or disruptions that happens in different syndromes. So can we work together? In our case, these are genome imbalances or like chromatin remodeling complex genes. And we are, let's say, are part of a big consortium in that area. Then, of course, we can also collaborate on projects like how to simplify and make accessible natural history study, which is like every foundation starts from scratch and organize however they can to make this work. And it's a lot of work from scratch, starting from zero. You have to have a highly motivated researcher or researchers, which normally do this pro bono on top of everything. And it's many times not feasible to do that. And but natural history studies are, you know, the basics that you ha should have as a let's say a fairly new condition for understanding, but also for clinical trials in the future. So all of these things can be worked out well in a collaboration style. But it's sometimes true that it's easier to progress faster if you do it alone. Although maybe ideally you would say collaboration will speed it up, but there are so many factors that influence that, and so many a little bit small differences in what each organization wants, that at the end it takes a lot of time, a lot of adjustments and, you know, compromises. That I guess that's sometimes the reason that different organizations do it, let's say, on their own, which is, I don't know if it's good or bad, but just this is how it is. So yeah, collaboration is the key, I would say, but then to make a successful collaboration is not that easy.
And it's to keep that the focus that you were mentioning before, where I am now, where do I want to go, and you know how to bring all this together to achieve that target, right? So keeping the focus while collaborating and partnership with others.
Yes, but you are not just because I think easily you can end up with kind of really working hard for a certain project, but then if you lose the track of what is also good
Yes.
for your patients, let's say, then you're just, you know, giving your time and energy for something that will not be directly useful for your cohort of patients. And then is this, you know, valuable? What for my purpose? I have a limited time. So yes, it's always like that you have to think which collaborations you will join. And yes, and which you can simply cannot because you don't have a unlimited time available.
Erica, it's been a lovely conversation. So let's close it on a more human side of all this. So, you know, I'm pretty sure you have great days, others a little less. But, you know, on the real tough days, what keeps you going? What gives you hope to keep going with all this work that you are doing?
Yes, I mean, of course, there are good and bad days, as you said, and on a bad day, sometimes some helps if someone from the community sends a message, "Oh, I'm so happy you're doing this, and thank you for everything you do," and like this. So this is one thing that, you know, gives you the motivation. Okay, so people do notice, they see the difference. They're, you know, grateful for everything that we as a foundation are doing. And on the other hand, when I felt really overwhelmed and I said, okay, so is all this effort that I do makes any difference? Is this worthwhile? It's moving so slow and so on and so on. But then I ask myself, so what would it be if I stop or if I wouldn't even start? And then you see what progress has been made, you know, when you look back on a longer period, what was 5 years ago and what is now. And then I kind of learned that small progress is still progress, you know. And yes, I think that's the main point, that even if sometimes the pace is not as high as we would wish for, still we are moving, we are moving, and if you just give up, then very few things happens on its own or nothing. Yeah, I think here I found the value that even if I don't think it's perfect or it's not, good enough, or yeah, but then again, when you look on a longer period, you say, yes, well, it was worthwhile, or there is a difference. So yeah, I think that's something that keeps me going and also brings hope that maybe for my child and also especially for new generations, they will have much better life, or let's say much more support available for them. So yeah, I think that's it.
And that's that brings to a bigger value of contribution, and it's really, really inspiring. Erica, thank you very much for sharing your journey, your honesty, and the so critical and very important work that you are leading in the different initiatives, especially on the foundation. It's really a powerful reminder, I think, for the rare disease community that putting patients at the center and showing up to contribute is not just a principle, but it has to be on a daily decision, basically. So thank you very much again for your time and availability. And to everyone listening, if this conversation resonated with you, please don't forget to follow the podcast and share it with someone who cares about making a real difference and impact. Thank you for now, and I'll see you soon for the next episode.
Thank you.